Good evening. Thanks for tuning in to the International Press Review. I'm your host, Jim Nelson. We're taping this program on Tuesday, July 9th, 2024. The International Press Review reviews news from different regions of the world, giving the listeners to this program a perspective and analysis of international news not often heard in the corporate mainstream media. The panelists for the program are Yukari Miyamai. Yukari reviews the Japanese press. Good evening, Yukari.
Good evening. Konbanwa. Minasan, yoroshiku onegai shimasu.
Joe Yuhas. Joe reviews the Western and Eastern European press. Good evening, Joe.
Good evening, Jim, and good evening, my fellow speakers here, and you estet kivano kadveshagatoin.
And Doug Vaughn. Doug covers news from Central and South America as well as the Caribbean basin. And good evening to you, Doug.
Howdy, folks. Estimados, desde los lagos grandes de América del Norte hacia el sur, rumbo en vivo, aquí estamos.
All right. Well, we'll get started. Go ahead, Yukari, with Japanese press.
Thank you. Before I go into specific news report, I want to say that Japanese mainstream media now are obviously censored. Even I was aware of deterioration of Japanese mainstream media for more than a few decades. I used to be able to read somewhat objective analysis within major newspapers, such as Asahi Yomiuri Mainichi Shimbun. Now, I'm not able to find cool-headed editorials in those newspapers. They all seem to parrot government official narratives, and I'm learning and trying to read between lines, which is something I heard about from journalists living under Soviet-era Eastern Europe. So I am alarmed about this. So with that in mind, I'm going to start with Tokyo governor election that just ended. The most frequent news coverage from Japan I saw during the last few weeks was about Tokyo governor election. There was a many governor election happening throughout Japan in various places, but Tokyo governorship is very important. The incumbent governor, Yuriko Koike, was re-elected for her third time yesterday. Koike has been known for breaking all her previous campaign promises during her 8 years of governorship. She tends to be theatrical and boast flashy policy agenda to improve social programs such as child care, overtime labor, public transportation, elder care, animal shelter, or infrastructure problems, but none of them have been achieved or even tried. One of her major campaign promise failure was closure and destruction of traditional Tsukiji fish market. This has impacted not only Tokyo residents, but the logistics of fish distribution system for the entire Japan, weakening quality control for the industry. So Koike promised transparency during the campaign, but her political activity have been riddled with scandals and published documents are heavily deducted. And in addition to Olympic scandals and COVID scandal, The recent expose shows that she has fabricated her academic record, and she never graduated from American University of Cairo in Egypt, as she claimed. Yuriko Koike's role in Japanese political system is to uphold and strengthen status quo power structure through bribery and corruption. She was also a minister of defense for less than a year in 2007 and seems to be still useful for US military interest, judging from guests celebrating her re-election result. Notably, she met Ambassador of Israel immediately after the confirmation of re-election. So this is a brand new news, and then there may be a more percussion about this. One thing to note is that the voting was very low rating of the voting. I think it was less than 50% for sure. There was a much more to come. Okay, next news that I made a notice is the accident at the Fukushima nuclear plant. On June 15th, fatal accident occurred at inside Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. The worker was found dead at the site where radiation dose in water was has been measured. We tend to forget that the declaration of state of emergency for this nuclear accident almost 13 years ago is still in effect. Level 7 nuclear disaster is ongoing affair even now. Currently, a victim of earthquake disaster that happened on January this year at Noto Peninsula has not been receiving adequate recovery aid from government. And in fact, government aid was recently terminated. Japanese government has given 10 trillion yen, approximately $100 billion, to Ukraine, yet it has neglected its own people. So this is how things are going in Japan. And by the way, this accident, the death of the worker at the nuclear plant, has not been very much covered in news. And by now, almost 1 month later, I don't find any coverage. So it's kind of disappearing. Okay, so last things is not so much as a news coverage directly, but I would like to explore, and then I would like other panelists to be able to comment on it on when they speak on this issue. I consider Japan is a vassal country to USA. So its fate is dependent on the path USA chooses. So I'm very concerned. In USA, we use word like freedom and liberty to be the most valuable attribute of this country. And often people here accuse other country like Iran or Cuba for not allowing freedom and liberty, while people in those countries chose to form a certain system of government different from that of USA. For example, This is something I would like Ibrahim's input sometime. Iran has been criticized for not allowing women to show more skin or requiring them to wear certain headscarf. Yet women in Iran have free college education and national health care, and the country have highest number of female doctors, so that women can be treated by female doctors more often than any country in the West. So I ask, what kind of freedom for women are more valued or preferred, and for what reasons? Personally, I prefer to have free education for women than being able to wear revealing clothing in public. I tend to think class equality is preferable freedom and liberty. At least we can examine our prejudice about other cultural value in other country and maybe show some respect. So that is one issue I would like to explore sometime in our forum. Also, currently, I heard US total debt is going $101 trillion. And unfunded liabilities like $217 trillion. And $318 trillion of debt against $209 trillion in total US asset, which is equal to, say, bankruptcy. The US government survives on money printing or creative accounting and propaganda. That's where BRICS is coming into discussion. So I wish to have more discussion on this matter because the multipolar world is developing in front of our eyes, and it is American interest to learn how to be in it instead of destroying everything when the world is moving away from its demand. So as a small country of Japan, the path of United States from here on is going to be a great significance, and I would like some of this to be discussed in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Yukari. That was Yukari Miyamai talking about news from Japan. And now we move on to Joe Yuhas and news from Western and Eastern Europe. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, it's only 14 minutes or so into the program, so I thought if that's okay with everybody, I respond to a couple of the things that Yukari mentioned. Is that okay? Okay.
Just be aware of your time.
Okay. So, Yukari, hello. I would say that Japan is hardly following the American model in its form of government. But of course, as you say, using the slogans that the Americans use, I would say Japan is maybe closest to either the European monarchies that have a parliament, a constitutional parliamentary system, or some of the Near Eastern monarchies, because, I don't know what your thoughts are. I think the powers of the Japanese emperor, although not used very much in public, are still quite strong. What are your thoughts about what I just said?
Well, monarchy in Japan is totally subjugated by the current ruling party's dominance, and they have been used for justifying a certain kind of stance. But really, at this moment, I wouldn't call them to have any power.
Okay, but nonetheless, it's still not a republic in the American model where one person is head of state, head of government, and commander in chief of the armed forces. It's much close to the British model. Many people would argue, as you do, that Charles is merely a figurehead. Figurehead or not, he is head of state. And not the prime minister. So, also, I think in case of Japan, you don't have anything like our Electoral College or our Senate, which are basically either non-democratic or anti-democratic or whatever you want to call them. Just some thoughts. I think with regard to the American national debt, the government in America doesn't print money. The American system is that the government borrows money from the Federal Reserve, which is a private for-profit bank. And yes, the United States is, in all practical terms, in bankruptcy. And I think that's absolutely not being discussed enough anywhere, but certainly more in Europe than it is in America. Any further thoughts on what I said, Yukari?
Well, in terms of the importance you place on emperor and is kind of a I don't have the same experience as Japanese person, so but whatever you think is whatever. We can talk about it, and it's for me it is important for me to elaborate our understanding and the way the narrative have been communicated in our media. And from where I'm reading Japanese news, I don't perceive the way you do, but it is very important that to know what is your perception is.
Well, look, I am merely saying, Yukari, that in Japan, the head of state and head of government are not the same human being. In America, they are. And that's a huge part of the American system. And this is the same in Britain, it's the same in Belgium, it's the same in Netherlands, it's the same in Sweden, it's the same in Norway. And it's the same also in all republics in Europe. You have a separate president and a separate prime minister. In America, we don't, that's one person. That's all. I don't want to bore you or anybody else any further. Should we go on, Jim?
Yeah, go ahead up with your segment.
Okay, so I'm going to change my clothes here. Nobody watch. Now I am the commentator on the European press. Well, certainly, as has been alluded to by Yukari, the elections in France are huge news in Europe, as are the elections in Britain. The elections in Britain turned out as predicted, and it is a Now, technically, Labour government, in terms of the lower house, of course, the British House of Lords continues as it is, as does King Charles. But the lower house, which is the one that selects the prime minister, et cetera, and so forth, with the approval of the House of Lords and the King, are now in the heads of a nominally Labour Party, which, however, is so different from the traditional Labour Party that the former Labour Prime Minister has quit his own party. Nevertheless, the move from Conservative to Labour is not to be trivialized and is not being trivialized because it may very well be something in the nature of a straw in the wind. So I think that what we have here is a electorate that is saying it's time for a change. And quite clearly, the right has not been sensitive or not sensitive enough to the growing discontent in Britain or been unable to do anything about it or whatever it is. Even though it was predicted, and even though it is not a drastic or dramatic move to the left, it is at the bare minimum a straw in some kind of a wind that needs to be understood without being overly simplistic about it. The very, very intriguing aspects include that the new Labour is much more supportive of Israel and much more supportive of the Ukraine war than the Conservatives were. And it, as some people might say, this is a side issue. Okay, it's a side issue, but all the same, it's a wind from an entirely different direction than we have seen in the past 2, 3, 4 years or more in most or much of Europe, certainly in the last couple of years. I also think that the, and I'm reflecting when I say I think, better simply put, I'm in agreement with many commentators in Europe who say that the question now becomes whether the Labour government is interested, because this is not at all clear, in undoing Brexit, where the British even making any moves in the direction of de-emphasizing the empire and re-emphasizing a connection in Europe. This will alter the balance of power in Europe radically, even if it's nothing but talk. Because Europe right now is basically dominated by three countries, and this is in some order, Russia, Germany, and France. But historically, there's been four. And after Brexit, the involvement of Britain in the overall dynamics of Europe became minimized. So this is the British election. I can say more about it later or answer any questions from any of your comment. The French elections, of course, are far more intriguing. Here in the first round, the predicted victory of the illiberals. And this follows the trend or the wind or the tides or whatever you want to call the in Europe for the past, depending on which part of Europe, looking at decades, years, etc., and so forth. And then comes the second round. And in the second round, the liberals outvote the illiberals. Well, if that's not an important straw in the wind, I would like to see what it is. The commentary on that ranges wildly, much, 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 much predictably, much, 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 much more wildly than the commentary on the British elections, because after all, the polls foretold the outcome in the case of the British elections. The polls completely were turned on their head on the second round of the voting in French. Right. So let's take the two extremes and then go on from there in terms of commentary on the French elections. On one side is an extreme that said it is a moment as momentous in history as the French Revolution. The people of France woke up over the time period between A and B and realized the enormous problems of a fascist, neo-Nazi, authoritarian, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, illiberal bunch of good-for-nothings. At the opposite extreme, predictably, if you've lived in the United States, come the statements, the first round was more or less legitimate. The second round was fraud. So if maybe you've heard that in America about elections. So the right is saying fraud. The correct sentiment of the French people was the pulse was taken in the first round. Then the manipulators, the evil people who, the evil progressive liberal bloc, stole the second round. In any case, the outcome gives us a French parliament, which, to use an American expression, is hung. No, at this point, there is no governing majority in the French Parliament as a result of the total outcome. Now I'll just go to plain old, more or less middle of the line commentary. What in fact that does is give Macron enormous power. Absolutely enormous power. Because the parliament's hand is more or less tied, and the French presidency to begin with is probably in constitutionally the strongest presidency on the European continent, or in any case, in contention for it. It's sort of like neo-royalist, not in the sense in which Yukar and I were talking about it, but in the sense of the ruling monarch. The president of France has enormous powers vis-a-vis the prime minister, and for that matter, even the parliament. But with a prime minister whose hands are tied because she does not have a majority behind him, her, and a parliament where there is no clear majority policy making, this makes the president of France a enormously powerful individual, and it is one of the three most important parties in a continent that is still hardly not nothing. The very, 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 very most appalling stuff that I have read about the French election will remind you of the very, 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 very most troubling things politically for me and for many commentators in America. I will begin with the extreme right who are saying fraud. It doesn't take much, and in fact, you can read this in so many words. There are voices in France that are calling for revolution, meaning not peaceful revolution, but bloody revolution. On the other hand, the same thing. Before this ultra-right becomes powerful in one way or another, we've got to do what we need to do, and again, revolutionary talk. Yukari, I see that you have raised your hand. Please, what have you to say?
Well, sometime I would like you to comment on Hungarian Prime Minister
Orban.
Viktor Orban visiting China after meeting with Putin. He's getting closer to those two powerful country, and Putin meeting with Modi recently, the Indian Prime Minister Modi. So this is very a big to me. It is a earth shattering movement, and then I would like you to comment if you can. Thank you.
You betcha. So, no matter what, we're dealing with what many, if not most, as voices are calling a potential change in the wind direction or swing of the pendulum, whatever you want to call it. And this is visible to many commentators in the real home places or bases of illiberalism. The popularity of Orban has never been as low as it is now. And there is also a lot of talk about the people in Russia becoming wary of the Putin regime. We also have situations in China where numerous people have been fired by Xi. I think Orban, as the dean of the illiberals, in his journey, which actually began in Kiev to talk peace with Zelensky, and then moved on to Moscow to talk with Putin, and is ending in Beijing in talking with Xi, are an attempt to put the wind back into the sails of illiberalism. However, many would say it is a passive way of doing this, not really an active way, and that the slogans are still the same slogans, which may not have the same power today that they had even a few months ago. The biggest one, of course, being peace. And again, here, more critical than anything else are the results of the French election. Now, of course, there are many other factors, to say the very least. Yukari, have I taken a step in the direction? Do you have a follow you wanted? Do you have a follow-up before I finish?
No, I'm very interested in how this particular meeting is perceived. And
Which one, the Putin one or the Xi one or both?
both.
Okay. I think the two are by absolutely no means the same, but they certainly overlap. The situation vis-a-vis Russia is that, in every sense of the word, Putin and Orban are brothers. She is not in by any means a classic illiberal whatsoever. He is a neo-Confucian. And so there is clearly an overlap and clearly a non-overlap, or we could call him a proto-Marxist neo-Confucian. So the Chinese foreign policy and the Chinese domestic policy are far more balanced, as Confucianism demands, than either the Putin or the Orban domestic and foreign policy. That doesn't mean that there is not seemingly an ennui in China. I will bring this to a conclusion in a minute and a half by saying that the situation in America and the American elections are not by any means unrelated to any of these things, either in my view or that of any commentator whatsoever. Nor is it outside the purview of me or any other commentator whatsoever that there is an interconnection among all of these things that is not merely political or economic and so on, but also has to do with direct work of intelligence agencies. That there are not interests in the American government as to what happens in France or Britain is silly, or to say, or that the French or the Russians or the Chinese or the Vatican does not have an interest in what goes on in France is also silly, or in America. So many, many people see outside hands in the pot. Well, my time is up. Thank you for your patience with me, and we move forward to the man in the yellow shirt.
Well, thank you, Joe. That was Joe Juhasz covering Western and Eastern European press. And now we move on to Doug Vaughn covering Central and South America, as well as the Caribbean basin. Go ahead, Doug.
Well, we're lucky that radio is colorblind because my shirt is not yellow.
Oh, what is it?
Well, you'll have to adjust your visual array there on your production board. It's somewhere between burnt umber and beige.
I can't
call
see this amber, but
let's
I
call it
call it.
bilge, drudge, maybe grunge color. Some variation of an earth tone,
What
but
Americans,
definitely not yellow.
what
In any
Ameri
event,
what
yes.
Americans call amber, Hungarians call yellow. I am actually telling you the truth. We say yellow like we don't have a special word for that. It looks like
There,
the color of mustard.
that a little too far from the Baltic to really know the color of amber. But that's what happens when you're an inland country without a seacoast, which is
Exactly.
my way of segueing to my segment, which involves another country which no longer has a seacoast, thanks to its neighbors having deprived it of an outlet to the sea in the 1890s. Bolivia is rendered an eternally, or at least internally, landlocked country. Its former coastal outlet was a narrow band that jutted westward from the Andean highlands into the desert of the Atacama along the Pacific coast. And that territory was, as I've mentioned on earlier programs, a bone of contention because it was loaded with, let's use the polite term, guano, which is bird dung. And the reason bird dung was so important to the European economies in the 1800s was because it's loaded with nitrates. And nitrates are a key component in explosives. And therefore, we had the so-called guano wars, the birdshit wars that occurred in the 1870s, 80s, largely financed by Great Britain on the one side and its rival Germany on the other. Germany had been reliant on pig manure as its major source of explosives, but there weren't nearly enough pigs to go around in order to be able to support the military that had been built up under Otto von Bismarck, the Prussian general and land baron who effectively ran Germany during the latter part of the 19th century. And so the two great rivals for control of the world launched small wars in South America between Bolivia, Peru, and Ecuador, and Chile, and ultimately seized the coastal port of Iquique, which was incorporated into Chile. And Chile and Peru divided that little western corridor that had been Bolivia's land outlet to the sea. Bolivia, nevertheless, had a navy. And remarkably, the main elements of the navy were controlled after World War II by German immigrants who were Nazis escaping justice after World War II. Thanks to the so-called rat lines that were formed by the United States, the British intelligence services, with complicity of the Vatican and especially the Croatian Ustaši-affiliated right-wing priests, that were ensconced in the northern part of Italy along the border with Austria in the Tyrol. Those movements, of course, included the legendary Butcher of Lyon, the head of the Gestapo in World War II in France, Klaus Barbie, who became a collaborator with successive right-wing governments ever since achieving exile and being given a post as a first a contractor, then a consultant, and finally as an actual officer in the aforementioned Bolivian Navy. Bolivia actually did have a small gunboat force on Lake Titicaca, which is the highest elevation large body of water in the world. But Barbie was most notorious for his training, arming, and supplying death squads to the Bolivian military, with the support of the Argentine military dictatorship in the 1970s, and culminating in the seizure of power by another military dictator, Hugo Banzer, in 1976, only to be overthrown in what was called the cocaine coup, led by a group of colonels and generals that were even more tied to these fascist forces and reliant upon them, but with virtually outspoken support by the Reagan administration in the United States during the 1980s. All that came to an end in 2005 when a new government was elected in Bolivia under the banner of MAS, which means in Spanish more. But those are also the letters of abbreviation for Movimiento al Socialismo, Movement Towards Socialism, which was first an organization of left-wing sympathizers, trade unionists, not merely politicians, but so-called base organizations, especially in the Federation of Peasants and also in the Mine Workers Union. Within the Peasant Confederation, which has an even longer abbreviation, CSTUBA, I believe, the Bolivian Association of Campesinos, that is, peasants and workers, including landless workers in the countryside, was divided during this period with an ascendant group led by Evo Morales. Around the people that grew coca leaf for a living. And they also had cooperatives which marketed this coca leaf, including to pharmaceutical companies in Europe, Bayer, of course, being the largest and most notorious because of its own long history of having been a source of material support for the German governments in both World War I and World War II, but also those informal networks of purchasers that we today call, for lack of a better term, cartels. And those cartels are actually groups of producers, suppliers and intermediary transportation networks that exist not only in Bolivia, mainly in the eastern lowlands, not so much in the much more indigenous highland areas, but also in neighboring Chile and Peru and Argentina and Paraguay. And especially in Ecuador and Colombia. but they also have affiliated networks in transportation and processing throughout Central America, and especially in Mexico, where all of these organizations in each country have been alternately at war with each other and ultimately at war with the United States since the 1970s, when Richard Nixon launched the so-called war against drugs. All of this comes to a head, in a sense, in the election of Evo Morales as the head of not only the cocoleros, the coca-growing farmers, but also as the emerging titular leader of the movement towards socialism, which has antecedents going back to the Cuban Revolution and its support for the attempted guerrilla warfare waged by Ernesto Che Guevara, who came to his demise in 1967 as a result of intervention by the United States in league with the Bolivian military. The reason I provide all this background is because of the very peculiar event which occurred on this recent June 26. On June 26, armored vehicles, including a couple of tanks, came out of their barracks in the neighboring town of El Alto, entered the capital city of La Paz. Bolivia actually has two capitals, Sucre and La Paz, but La Paz is the highland formal seat of state. And they proceeded down the main boulevard to the Plaza Murillo in the center of town and battered the gates, rammed into the gates of the presidential palace, which is known as the Casa Grande, the big house. And that's where the coup leader will ultimately end up, not in the White House or the presidential palace, but under arrest and in the big house, that is the penitentiary, where he joins Luis Camacho. And Camacho was the mayor and then governor of one of the eastern province around the city of Santa Cruz, which is the largest in Bolivia. And he was very much an advocate of close ties not only to the cocaine cartels, which formerly operated in the country, but also with the United States and with the right-wing government of Donald Trump, which had in fact supported a coup d'etat in which Camacho was implicated in 2019. So what we have here is a very interesting kind of echo of those events in 2019. 2 days early on June 24th, the president, elected president, Luis Arce, also of the MAS, the Movement Towards Socialism, the ruling party, sacked the general, Juan José Zúñiga, who is the head of the military and specifically the chief of staff of the army. And Arce did this because Zuniga had gone on television and said that under no circumstances would the former president, Evo Morales, be allowed to take office if he were in fact to run again for president, which he is in fact doing as candidate of the Movement towards socialism. And those elections are to be held next year. So Zúñiga, without any legal authority, simply said that Morales can no longer be the president of this country. And he was quoted as saying that he would not allow the Constitution to be trampled to disobey the mandate of the people. Now, that's rather curious because Arce was elected along with the support of Morales precisely because the military had backed the ouster of Morales, who chose to run again in 2019, despite a constitutional ruling by the Supreme Court, which said that the Constitution prohibited him from running for a third term. Morales denounced this, insisted he was entitled to run, and then a coup d'etat took place, largely organized by the conservative forces under Camacho in the city of Santa Cruz and the surrounding area there on the plains, the Eastern Plains, rather than support from the highlands population, the miners and the cocoleros that had supported Mas and traditionally were the base for Evo Morales. So in 2019, although Zúñiga was not directly implicated, he cites this earlier coup d'etat by reference to saying that under no circumstances should Morales be allowed to run again. And Arce very quickly not only called him on the carpet, but basically sacked him and told the press that he had acted, that Zuniga had acted without any authority and could no longer be trusted, that it was dangerous to be calling for preventing somebody to run for office, and that this was effectively a coup d'etat in the making. And sure enough, within 48 hours, Zuniga led troops from the barracks and directly attacked the presidential palace. But now things get a little more complicated, and I see I'm running out of time. We'll have to wrap it up. The rumors are flying, and they include accusations that Arce himself had supported Zuniga's coup in order to prevent Evo Morales from running. Morales is said to be the source of these rumors that blame his former ally Arce and the entire socialist project, or at least the party that represents it, MAS, is now thrown into turmoil as to which of these two candidates it will support in these elections. Stay tuned, it's going to get even stranger and creepier in this sordid history of coups in Bolivia.
Thank you so much, Doug. That was Doug Vaughn covering Central and South America as well as the Caribbean Basin. So we have come to the end of the program. The panelists for this evening have been Yukari Miyamai, Doug Vaughn, and Joe Yuhas. I've been your host, Jim Nelson. Tune in next month for another edition of the International Press Review. I also, before we end the program, just want to, since we are going to be put on the platform for the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center, we lost a good friend, Ron Forthover, in the past week. And he was a big supporter of this program as well as the Peace Center. So I just want to mention his loss, and he will be missed. And with that, we come to the end of this program.
Me too. He was a wonderful person.
Quick correction. During my presentation on June 11th, I said incorrectly that Nagasaki bomb was hydrogen bomb, but it was actually a plutonium bomb. Thank you, listeners, for collection, and I appreciate for your support.